This is a great episode today. This is my great friend, Michael Gene Favor. I've known him since I was about 6 years old, playing like t-ball together and other sports. This guy has always been passionate about fitness, health. He ended up training to become a physical therapist. He comes on the show today. He talks about pain and mental health, the challenge of staying motivated when you have to go see a physical therapist to do all those exercises all the time to get better. It's really a great conversation. I think you guys are really going to like it. If you are tuning in today, one thing I would greatly appreciate is if you suggest this podcast to anyone who you think might find it valuable. It would greatly help me reach a bigger audience. I'm trying to do this old-fashioned way, by word of mouth. And just anyone who you think could benefit from this podcast, I'd greatly appreciate if you pass it along. All right, enjoy the show.
Damn, man, are you at the office right now?
Yeah, I thought this was a nice place to record it. It's quiet, no one's here on Saturday, so yeah.
Dude, well, nice. I am at home at my new podcast studio / living room in my apartment in Philly.
Cool, man. How's the new place?
It's very, very nice. I'm excited to, I'll tell you more about it after the recording. But I'm stoked to have you here, man, to hear about the mental health aspects of physical therapy.
Yeah, I'm thrilled and flattered to be able to speak to these concepts. I know that it's a big part of physical rehabilitation. So just for all clarity, I guess a little bit of background about myself. So I'm an orthopedic and sports physical therapist with Stanford Healthcare in Redwood City, California. I work out of an outpatient orthopedic sports like physical therapy center. We see maybe, I don't know, between 150 and on a busy day, 200 patients a day, which is a lot. It's all like one-on-one care, which is great. We have a wonderful team of therapists, about between 15 and 17 depending on the day, and it's, yeah, the patient I see are orthopedic or sports related injuries, but not everything from like recreational, you know, your weekend warrior, all the way up to your high school and even some college athletes. But yeah, it's a nice spectrum of patient demographics, but they all are recovering from injury, not only physically, emotionally, but also psychologically. And to be able to speak to these aspects, particularly with the cognitive component of recovery, I'm really excited about.
Yeah, no. And, you know, just so the listeners know, I've known Mr. Gene Favor here, geez, I don't even know how long. I'm 32 now. We probably met when we were like six.
Yeah, I was thinking back myself this morning, like, man, with the introductions and like how far back does it go? Kindergarten for sure.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, so, I mean, I was thinking today about kind of my journey and how I think physical therapy and like mental health are related. I guess kind of like the first thing I really want to talk to you about is how, like, you know, I think every single one of your patients probably has some kind of physical pain. And I think it's almost, well, it's just very, very challenging to be emotionally painless when you have physical pain. Like, it's so connected. You're in a crappy mood if you're in pain. Like, you don't sleep as well. Like, I find myself more irritable, just down on life more when I have an injury. So how do you deal with kind of how that aspect of physical therapy is related to mental health?
Yeah, so like the pain experience of going through a physical injury, there's a lot of science behind this that's coming out, and it's gotten the term pain science even, and it comes, the Australians are kind of leading the front on the national, on the international level on this, and so you have different types of pain, right? So you have like your nociceptive, which is like you actually have tissue harm or damage that actually causes that initial inflammatory response. And then you have your neurogenic, where it's actually an injury to a particular nerve. This is where you get like shooting or radiating symptoms, and then you have your more centralized pain. And so the centralized pain, it usually falls into more the long-term persistent pain, so beyond like a 12-week time point. And so the way that our bodies and our emotions deal with these different types of pain is quite fascinating. And we really can only scratch the surface. We could do a whole series on the different types of pain and how that affects the anatomy, and then thus influences the emotional and the psychological response. I encourage your listeners to look into some of the Australians, specifically like Lorimer Moseley. He has a book out, Explain Pain, and then there's Explain Pain, the Supercharge, that really gets into the nitty-gritty of these concepts. So from my standpoint, it's important to understand, and then not only have the understanding, but then be able to convey the concepts to the patient that pain is not derived from our periphery, right? So if you like bang your finger with a hammer per se, the pain response is actually derived in the brain, right? It's where you're sending a benign signal to, from the periphery, from the finger up to the brain, and it's the brain's contextual interpretation of that physical stimulus that determines whether it's painful or not. Lorimer Moseley, the same guy and researcher, has a nice TED talk on it where he gives an example of a snake bite, where the first time that he had a snake bite, he like just brushed it off. Second time that he thought he had a snake bite, which was really just a stick poking him in the same area, he had the same like, and he had a much more augmented or alarmist response to it. So when it comes to pain, it's really quite conceptual, based off like what the patient's experiencing at the time, what their prior experience has been. And so dealing with the emotional component of that is, it's really challenging. So the way that that I go about it and triage this from a physical therapy standpoint is, first we have to identify like what type of pain it is, whether it's nociceptive, neurogenic, or more the centralized component, because inevitably that's going to influence the type of interventions or approach that we're going to take to it. With your nociceptive pain, where it's actually you have tissue harm, you have a traumatic injury, yeah, it's going to be like what they call your price, right? You're going to be doing your compression, your elevation, your protection, your standard like acute injury means. And even people, other healthcare providers will give like anti-inflammatory medications or pharmacological management in these instances. Same thing with the neurogenic-based symptoms, where you may get they give like your the referring physician may give like gabapentin or some like specific type of pharmacological management that will soothe the nerve itself. And then really when you get into this tertiary group, what so it's transitioned different names. So it was previously chronic pain, then it transitioned to persistent pain, and now it's like nociceptive centralization of pain, which you have. And I think what's in a name is really the perception of the patient, right? When and so that tertiary group, it really I think requires a lot more like conceptualization and cognitive and emotional.
But so I guess one of my questions is like, what do you say to the patient who is not participating in physical therapy or maybe not giving it very good effort due to the pain, and like they are mentally held back from participating in the activity, or even consistently doing the activity because they almost have that mental block, A, because of the pain, and then later I want to get into just simple motivation to like do the work. But let's just talk about pain for now.
Yeah, so as I was kind of alluding to, it comes back to you as the provider kind of understanding like the type of pain that they're experiencing of those three categories, and then how you go about approaching that. So if pain is a primary limiting fact, like give a prime example of this this past week, right? So I have a patient who her motivation is, well, let me give some context, right? So 55-year-old woman with whose total knee, she just had a total knee replacement, but she's really physically active, hiking, even was previously doing some running prior to the surgery, which led to this. And so from that patient's standpoint, she wanted to participate in the exercises, but she literally every time she did, she'd get this joint effusion, right? And so how do we approach that? We need to be able to have a multidisciplinary approach that we need to, one, not only scale the exercises and the form of rehab so that she's not getting this per, this this recurrent like boom bust scenario, but then we also need to get assistance from other medical providers, from the surgeon, to be able to assist. Like he put her on Celebrex, which is like a really powerful means of helping to bring down the effusion within the joint, and then even did a joint aspiration. So seeking other like physical means to be able to reduce that, and then to your specific concept question as far as like how we deal with that mentally is recognizing like what are the physical barriers and what is the person's perception of like what is the pain that's causing it. The brain is there to protect the body, and if she believes that every time she goes to bend her knee or to get it to stretch a little bit further or even straighten out that she's doing physical harm to her body, then it's going to be an uphill battle for her recovery, and her prognosis and her health-related quality of life will likely be reduced. So being able to put that into context for her, hey, when you bend your knee, you're not doing yourself undue harm here, right? This is not doing additional stress, like stress to the joint. Yeah, you do have some fluid in the joint. Yes, you have had this major trauma, but these are safe and effective exercises to be able to do. And though in the short term they are leading to further distress and discomfort, if we go really gently and we go in a structured approach, that this is actually giving love and the therapeutic effect to your healing knee. And so being able to reframe that is critical. So they I can stop there. I feel like I could go on and on, but
No, but I think that concept is very interesting. Like you have to almost, some amount of pain is expected and warranted, but it's not necessarily causing further damage down there. You may in your brain think it is, but you know, if you have an understanding, like you're saying, of like basic anatomy, and that's why it's so important we have to educate our patients on you know, their own health concepts so we can kind of get what's going on. I think it is easier to kind of motivate yourself to work through some means of pain. It just kind of reminds me when I last did physical therapy, they had me using a blood flow restriction machine, and you ended up selling me an old machine, also a blood flow restriction machine. And you know how like I, it was essentially like a tourniquet that I would put around my leg, and it would be this incredible amount of pain, but because we were not using as much weight, it was, although it hurt, and they would always say it felt like I was bench or excuse me, squatting like 500 pounds. It's a lighter load, and so this is a safe exercise for your leg. So even though it hurts, it's really good to work through the pain, and you're actually going to get a more healing process in the end because of it.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty. That was a great example with the blood flow restriction training, and even, right? The nice thing about that is, you know, not getting too far into the science with the BFR, but which is short for the blood flow restriction, is that it does have an analgesic effect and a therapeutic window like of 45 to 60 minutes, where you can like if someone's, I have a gentleman right now who's trying to get back to tennis. And he can't load, like he can't get his, and he has patellofemoral pain. So that's like pain over the front of his knee, where right where his kneecap meets his femur. and he can't load, meaning he can't like do any like single limb movements at the gym to be able to strengthen his quadricep, which is an essential component to being able to regain his function because of the amount of discomfort and pain that it puts on him. Yet when we put on the tourniquet and specifically stratify the amount of pressure based off his limb occlusion pressures, then he's able to actually go through the movements and be able to have a much less pain experience during the exercise itself. So yeah, I'd say that there's on the whole, I'm quite conservative, but as far as like how far we'll get people to push into discomfort and physical pain, and then the emotional and psychological components that come along with that. But if you do have an underlying knowledge of the anatomy and being able to reframe this, it's for the patient. It's, I mean, that's essential. There's these things called that I've termed thought viruses. So a thought virus is a thought and/or belief that promotes further physical disability. An example would be, so if I think back even to this week, so I had this woman who unfortunately had a mechanical fall, taking out her trash can, and she had rib fractures. She had like three of them on her left side, and she came into the clinic, and she was like, had the belief that it was not her ribs, but actually her spleen on her left side. And she goes, every time I move or laugh or even roll over in bed, I get this excruciating pain, and I feel like my spleen's going to explode. And I was like, that's interesting that you have a concern about your spleen. You're right, that is like the correct anatomical location. And it really took. And like my words fall flat against a strong belief system, right? So I could sit there and try and convince her, just like I could sit there and try and convince the wall that it's not her spleen, but actually her fractured ribs. But it wasn't until she actually got a CT done within the urgent care that showed that her visceral organs were all intact and safe, that she really came back in the following session and was like, okay, I understand that this is more like a bony lesion or fracture that will self-heal. We just need to kind of gently work through like these movements, rather, and that you're not going to be doing yourself or further harm or discomfort. And yeah, so the thought viruses are really, they can really be pervasive and really and further disabling for the folks. And stemming off that, I know I'm kind of branching off your initial question, but I do think that it's related, right? So the thought viruses, when patients express this, using another analogy, is like you don't know whether this thought or this belief is a sandcastle or a pebble. And what I mean by that is they may have a whole underlying belief system that's linked to that initial thought. So it's important for you to identify the sandcastle versus the pebble, because I'll give another candid example that's very similar, where I have a patient coming in with low back pain who recently had like an MRI performed, and their doctor is like, yeah, this is like the worst spine that I've seen in maybe 5 years. And you got this disc bulge, and you got this, that, or the other on the imaging. And then what we know is that imaging does not always correlate with like someone's physical pain and/or their fu physical function. And so coming in with that imaging, as well as his brother also having like back pain, and his father also having like a scoliosis deformity, this person had a strong belief system, a sandcastle, that this was a congenital and inevitable issue that he was going to have to deal with, and that there was limited means
Interesting.
of being able to go around it. And so if I, as the provider, come right in and try and like attack that gentleman's belief system by saying, you know, they're, the imaging doesn't correlate, or the imaging's there, but it doesn't really matter for what we're gonna change our approach from the exercises. I'm gonna lose that person's buy-in and that rapport immediately. Rather, when you have the sandcastle, what I need to do is you need to chip away at it. Meaning, like, you need to start to with your words and with your communication, and what is even more powerful from that standpoint is getting the having small psychological and physical wins for that patient. Maybe their first win is being able to do a squat without pain. Maybe it's being able to do like a mini a plank on their knees, and these small wins, and acknowledging this and making the patient really aware. Wow, it's really impressive that you're able to do this, that, or the other, despite the imaging that we saw initially when you started coming in. And so you need to shift that mindset and that belief system over time, versus the other gentleman who comes in, right? You get like someone coming in with back pain who has the imaging from their physician who doesn't have all those other contextual factors associated with it. This is your pebble. This is where you pull up graph and you show them that, hey, at 40 years of age, 60% of us have disc degeneration. This is an over-medicalization. And they're like, oh, great. I'm so relieved to hear that this is like just a part of being human and naturally aging. And just like our hair goes white and our skin wrinkles and changes over time, doesn't mean that's not a painful experience. And when you look at the anatomy on the interior and it goes through these changes over time, nor does this have to be a painful experience. But it comes back to that contextual component about how the brain interprets the actual physical sensations that the body's experiencing.
Interesting. I think that's kind of like almost normalizing it, like, hey, I bet a lot of other 50-year-olds are going through a pain kind of similar to this. Maybe helps you think of that this pain is like, okay, this is just something everyone deals with in some respect. I can maybe live with this kind of constant level of pain versus maybe taking more of a victim's mentality. So another kind of question I kind of have, I think it's probably one of your biggest challenges as a therapist, I would guess at least, is patient motivation. And like patient motivation, I think it's kind of easy in some respect when they're with the physical therapist, when they're hanging out with a dude like you who's like, geez, what are you, 7% body fat, yoked out of your mind? And they're like, yeah, I want to work. But then when they're at home, and you give them essentially physical therapy homework, like you need to do this on your own time, these exercises, stretches, whatever, like what percentage of your patients truly follow through with your instructions? I bet it's not nearly what you would like. So can you talk about that, kind of like how you deal with patient motivation when it comes to physical therapy?
I sure can. Now, I'm going to warn you, Logan, this is a hot topic for me, something that I'm really passionate about. And so I have several topics here, subtopics that I like to talk about. And so it's going to be a
Well,
longer.
we like rants here at Talk Mental Health Love Noon, tangents, the whole nine yards. Let's hear it, man.
Great. Yeah, so then this is something that's been quite challenging. And I'm going to first just preface that when you look at rehabilitation and physical therapists in general and their mindset from the clinician standpoint, is that it's quite easy to say that that I've led the horse to water, right? So that I have given this patient comes in, they are well, let's use a different clinical example. Perfect example is like shoulder impingement syndrome. That means like essentially when you raise you have pain in your shoulder every time you raise your arm, either behind your back, or behind your head, or up overhead, in any means. And it can also really be pervasive on people's sleep patterns, right? So that's the clinical example that we'll go forward with. And you give this person like the best standard of care. There's a ton of research out there that helps guide us as clinicians in being able to help this person with their shoulder. Oh.
You're talking about leading a horse to water, showing a patient what to do, but then it kind of gets lost from there.
Yeah, so it's easy from the healthcare provider standpoint to lead the horse to water, meaning you give them all the information, all the exercise that they otherwise need to be able to improve their shoulder health or their knee health, and your job as the provider is all done. Yep, hands washed, good. You gave the quality care, and I would say that that's not enough. I would say that you need to be looking at, as a provider, you need to be looking at yourself in the mirror before you're looking at the patient and talking about adherence. So the first bit that I have on this is that the medical system on the whole has conditioned the American public to take a passive approach to their medical care. So any other provider that you see, be it your dentist, be it your primary care doctor, be it your orthopedist, that every if you have some health issue that you enter the healthcare system with, it's kind of expected that they're either going to do some procedure, or they're going to give you some advice, or they're
Or
going
a
to
pill.
or a pill to be able to overcome this. And we're in the unique position in physical therapy where we actually the person comes in, and we have the expectation that we need to empower this person to take an active role where they actually don't need to enter the healthcare system, where they know what the issue is with their body, they know what steps they need to take to be able to do it, and then they have that self-efficacy to be able to take that to the next level, so that they can not only just have improved function and pain relief within the 6 weeks or 8 weeks that they're within physical therapy, but moving forward with that. And so recognizing that as a provider is essential, right? You need to understand that that the American public is coming in with the perception that you're going to either rub on their shoulder, you're going to move their arm, you're going to do this or that, but rather taking that active approach, it's hard. And then this gets directly to behavioral change. So behavioral change, I don't care who you are, what it is, as humans, it's hard to adapt new behaviors when we're over the age of 21. The adult does not adapt as well as the younger individual does to being able to adopt these new behaviors. And so this has been a professional and a personal vendetta for me. And I utilize the what they call the fog behavior model. It's built by a psychologist out of Stanford University who does a wonderful job. So you can look up his book, Tiny Habits, where he talks about behavior. He talks about an equation. Behavior equals motivation plus action plus the prompt. And so motivation is like and he gives the analogy that motivation is emotionally driven. And just like the tides of the ocean inevitably will ebb and flow, so will motivation. And so if you rely on the behavior based solely on motivation alone, you're inevitably going to have this ebbing and this flowing constancy. And the behavior in this instance is actually the exercises, performing the exercises, right? Or taking an active part within the rehabilitation process. Rather, what you need to focus on as the provider is the other two. One, the prompt, and then also the action or the feasibility of them to be able to perform that action. You need to give them tangible and easy approachable steps that they for this person that they can do no matter what. And this means like looking at contextually within their lifestyle what they have the availability to do and the resources for, right? This is being really creative during the COVID pandemic where people don't have access to the gym and they don't have the same resources. And so what BJ Fox talks about is the way that you can foster this from a cognitive and a psychological loop is that you need to not only have these feasible means, actionable steps that he uses the example that he wanted to build the behavior of flossing his teeth every day. So he made it really easy to do by putting the little floss pick by the edge of the sink, and he would floss. He started with one tooth. So the smallest of habits, but the critical component is that it was consistency, the belief that he could actually floss one tooth, and then the physical celebration. So physical and like a vocal celebration where he would actually do a fist pump and you would be like, yes, good. Actually, stimulate that art, what may seem superficial or inauthentic celebration, actually releases dopamine. The dopamine then actually, you can think of it as like fertilizing that circle, that neurological loop, so that his body's going to myelinate that nerve pathway, and he's going to be more likely to do that behavior again, because when he now flosses two teeth, he gets an additional hit of dopamine. And so he goes into the psychology of it, but he does a wonderful job of like breaking it down to be really simple. And so having this this theoretical framework has been really helpful for myself personally, but then also professionally. Why we have the recipe in front of us to become the person that we want to become, yet we often fall short. Right, they call it the self dissonance. Right, where there's a discrepancy between the person that you want to be and the person that you actually see when you look in the mirror, right? And so that's not from a physical standpoint. That's just like from a self conceptual standpoint.
Well, if I could interject real quick on this one concept that you're talking about of creating these cycles, we learned about this one thing in kind of neurology, this concept of connectomes. And your brain is kind of made up, of course, as a sponge. We always hear that, right? And it literally, when we do our cadaver dissections in medical school, it kind of looks in some respect like a sponge, but it's made up of all these different nerve pathways. And, you know, I think the easiest way to think of these connectomes concepts is like, you know, we were baseball players. So these pitchers or even like golfers, the more they do this particular action, they're building these kind of nerve pathways. And this may sound kind of gross to some people, but I think it's kind of an important concept. You know, when I went through medical school, we did dissections of everything. I'm sure you had to do dissections too as a physical therapist. We dissected the brain. And when you dissect the brain, you can actually see sometimes like these like kind of pathways. They almost look like strings in some respect, very, very small strings. But when we would make slices and cuts of the brain just to kind of analyze and see the different layers and what it consisted of really for it to enhance our learning, you could see kind of these like small, like almost string-like, they looked like it. You of course couldn't extract the strings. But that's kind of what I'm like when you say things like that, like building those kind of pathways, I actually think is myelinating those nerve pathways and building those nerves stronger. So it's more likely that you can make that same decision again, like you said, to kind of floss your teeth every day. I think that was such an interesting concept you brought up.
Yeah, I say right on with that. And yeah, so not only do these neurological loops exist like from a physical standpoint where you can actually dissect them, but then also like on the there's the concept out there that nerves that fire together wire together, right? So then it's like this electrical impulse as well that it begets, you know, we don't otherwise be able to see it on a physical level necessarily, because it actually has to do with like the nerve impulses. But yeah, the connectome, it's a great example for sure. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Logan. That's exactly what I was describing. And then, so on the one hand, when we're trying to foster motivation, you don't focus on the motivation necessarily. That I'll get to that in a moment, but first off, it's like, what are the tangible steps? So if you identify the action that the person needs to take, the location and the time and the resources necessary, and you actually have them verbalize that to you, they're three times more likely to actually follow through with that behavior versus if you're like, hey, you're going to do this shoulder exercise. Great. I'll see you next week. Right. It's like, oh, no.
Give me three sets and come back. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, where are you going to do this? What time are you going to do this? And then, like, what do you have the resources necessary? And have them voice that back to you. That in itself, though it seems simple, as I mentioned, it triples their likelihood of actually being able to partake in the movement. and then having them celebrate. So I'll have them celebrate within a clinic, and this in itself, right? So it, again, people usually find it quite humorous, and it's important to have that laughter and that endorphin response, which, getting back to your pain component, that having humor within rehab is great, because it does have that endorphin release, which blocks physical pain and also improves their overall experience and gives them this the response of having a joyful or pleasurable experience within physical therapy, thus making them more likely to come back and see you again. So getting specifically to the M, within the equation, the motivation of that B equals motivation plus action and the prompt. The prompt we'll discuss in a moment. But then, yeah, so motivation is really interesting because it's not the same for everybody. You have to understand from the clinician standpoint, what is the underlying driver of why this person is coming to see you? So let me candidly say, I work in Silicon Valley, and so I get a lot of tech folks. And so especially in the last 18 months with COVID, that we're getting a lot of like upper quarter issues, either neck and or shoulder, because of the static positioning. And then also people moving towards like their home setup on screen, in their screen time exponentially increasing, thus perpetuating like more postural and musculoskeletal based pain. And so you get these individuals who are in the tech world who come in and they are inconvenienced by the discomfort that they have in their shoulder. And it's essentially a cognitive distraction for them during their workday, versus the person that comes in who's a young father or mother, and their shoulder pain, they're coming to see you because they have the same exact shoulder pain, same exact diagnosis as the young professional in the tech world. But when you ask them their goals and you ask them like, what is the underlying, you know, how is this influencing their life? They're like, yeah, so I can't pick up my young child and lift them up overhead. They love it when I do this for them, right? And so that's really powerful. So one, in the first scenario, the person is simply inconvenienced. There'll be, as soon as they're out of physical pain, be that a medication or with the exercises, they're done, right? They are gonna self-discharge, their inconvenience is reduced, they have other priorities. Yet the second person is coming to see you because it's impacting the father or the mother that they want to be, which if you can consistently link the different exercises, movements, etc., back to their underlying driver, that is going to be a potent stimulus for them, and something that they're not going to go home and go, okay, I got to get my external rotation of my shoulder really strong. They're going to go home and they're going to be saying, man, I really want to lift little Lily or little Tommy up overhead, and so I can be the best father or mother or parent that I can possibly be. That's critical. And this gets at an underlying component of self-identity. So often with physical injury, so a lot of young therapists love to treat athletes, and they love to treat athletes because of this high motivational component, where their high motivational component actually stems from a loss of self-identity when they become physically injured. And with the person that is just inconvenienced by the discomfort, the musculoskeletal discomfort, versus when you actually get at that identity component, be it an athlete, be it the mother or father, be it the older individual who's rehabbing from the total joint replacement, whose self-reliance and independence, which is critical. That's, you know, in the older adult population for their overall mental health and psychological well-being, they will work just as hard, if not harder, than the athlete because of that self-identity component and understanding what goes into our self-perception of who we are as a person. That's critical. And identifying like who we are and why we, you know, why we exist essentially. And this gets into more philosophy, and we could go down that route as well. I'd encourage your listeners to look up the work of Simon Sinek, where he has two books, you know, several books out there, but the ones Start With Why and Find Your Why, which is your underlying purpose. It helps you to helps the readers and the listeners to better conceptualize, like look back historically on their lives of what has helped them to develop, to see their greater mission and their greater vision in life. And from my standpoint as a healthcare provider, having gone through that on a personal level, through the Simon Sinek means, is it helps me to better identify what are the underlying drivers for this person. Like, who do they see themselves on a social concept? And then how does this physical injury impact that? And then because when you start to get to someone's identity and their underlying, self-realization as to who they are and how this is limiting for them, that's going to be critical and a powerful leverage for you as the provider to stimulate the motivation that you initially had. So again, I could go on and on about this, Logan. This is really a soft topic for me. I it's a really big pet peeve of mine when I hear colleagues or within the rehabs saying, yeah, this patient's not adherent, like they're not doing their stuff at home. It's like, yeah, well, look at the teacher, not the student. That's where you got to look first. And how can you stimulate or the behavior change, underlying identifying the self-belief system of that individual, and contextually, how does this physical injury influence or impact their life? Because that's really where you're gonna start to change the behavior, and thus when you change the behavior, you get the physical improvements and the better functional outcomes.
Yeah, you know, and it really makes me think how I want to apply it to my role, you know, as a psychiatrist in training, and then of course a future psychiatrist, because, you know, there's two things about motivation that I was thinking of when you were, you know, talking, and I like that long tangent. That was fantastic. Thank you. I mean, first, there's like the motivation. I mean, a lot of what I do, of course, is pharmacology-based pills. That's not, of course, all I want to do, but especially in the midst of my training, when just the way it is right now, it's just a lot of pills. And there's a big motivation component there where we, too, also, I hear a lot of providers who complain, this patient is not adherent to their medication. They even make a lot of antipsychotic medication now that is long-acting injectables, we call it, where we put a shot into your shoulder in your butt, and it slowly releases the medicine for a month or even sometimes 2 months at a time. Because so many times that people do well in the hospital while they take the medicine, they leave the hospital, they don't keep taking the medicine, and then they end up back in the hospital. And, you know, it's easy, I think, for psychiatrists especially to complain like, oh, if this patient just purely took the medicine. But yeah, like getting to what you said, like, well, we have to be better teachers on, you know, why to take the medicine, why you should take it every day rather than just kind of complaining about it. And, you know, at least I take medicine chronically every day. And it's quite something, I truly hate it. It's a pain in the butt to always have to make sure you have enough, go to the store, get some. You can't remember sometimes if you actually took it or if you didn't take it. I've taken two doses before because I was like, wait, did I take it 10 minutes ago? You know, and it's just very, very hard and challenging. And I actually try to make analogies to other habits that I do in my life without thinking about it, kind of like brushing my teeth and flossing. Or even wearing glasses. Like, I don't necessarily like doing those things, but I need to do those things to remain healthy. And that's at least one of the motivations I use in order for me to take my pills every day. But I really don't think that's enough. Like, I need to, that might work for me, but it's not going to work for other patients. I need to apply some of those skills that you were just talking about, because I don't want to become one of those jaded psychiatrists that just complains that people don't do what I say. Like, I need to learn to teach my patients to why they should be adherent, not just say, you need to do this because I said so. I'm the medical provider. I know everything. I'm, you know, this whole ivory tower kind of analogy. And then, you know, the second part of motivation that I was thinking of in my future role, and this is kind of be the other subject I really want to talk about today, is, you know, psychiatry in a perfect world, and at least how I want to practice it, it's so much more than a medication, you know, like there has to be other things that you do as a patient, I think, in order to be healthy, one of which exercise consistently, sleep consistently, you know, relatively good diet, not consuming an insane amount of recreational substances and other stuff like that. And, you know, I need to learn how to motivate my patients to do those kind of healthy endeavors, like just going on a walk every day. And so I really want to try to build a healthcare system as I, you know, gain more clout and leadership in this industry as a up and coming provider, like how to almost blend psychiatry with physical therapy. Like I get a little frustrated that in my eyes, only really like primary care doctors and orthopedic doctors, maybe like internists and stuff, make referrals to physical therapists. Whereas me as a psychiatrist, I can only make a referral to a physical therapist when it's like, well, that patient's not walking ever, but like, cause they're in pain, excuse me. Like it's always like pain-based. But what if that patient just doesn't go on walks cause they're so lazy, and not lazy, but maybe like super depressed is what I'm saying. Like doesn't have any kind of real like motivation or, you know, consistency or patterns that they actually exercise on a consistent basis, something that'd be wonderful for their emotional health too. So what do you think of this concept where like psychiatry referring patients to physical therapy for purely emotional pain rather than just simply physical pain as we always think of it now?
Yeah. Wow, Logan, that's great. So that totally resonates with me from the standpoint that we know that though we like to simplify and into like silos as far as like physical and spiritual and like mental component or psychological components of someone's well-being, we know that these are interrelated. And so I would say that we know that physical exercise has a really powerful means of improving a lot of the mental health conditions. Everything from depression to anxiety to fear. There's even this concept called kinesiophobia, which maybe your listeners are familiar with, where it's like a fear of movement after a particular injury. And so we know the evidence is pretty convincing as far as trying to normalize someone's like hormonal response, everything from oxytocin to serotonin and dopamine and the endorphins that we touched upon previously, that having a cohesive and collaborative and multidisciplinary approach to someone's care, be it a mental health issue or a physical one, that being able to utilize our skill set from a physical therapy standpoint versus the reciprocating factor where we see like someone's depression or anxiety disorder being a primary limiting factor for them, where we need to be referring to you all as well. And so we know that the multidisciplinary approach, the collaborative care, where we're treating the whole person rather than just their mentality or their cognitive component or their physical injury, is going to pale in comparison to the collaborative effort. And there's even the International Organization of Physical Therapy and Mental Health. They've come out with like a policy, different policy statements about how of this interrelated and collaborative effort, where it's a multidisciplinary approach. You can find more about that. Again, it's International Organization of Physical Therapy and Mental Health, where you're getting more of that collaborative care between the psychiatry, the psychologist, and the physical therapist. So yes, I totally see that being a role. And I think that as healthcare continues to evolve and continues to move forward, where you're seeing more of these, you know, all under one roof type healthcare systems that branch beyond our current system with the third-party payers that is more traditional, that I think that we will see better outcomes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the last kind of topic I want to really touch on, because I know you're a super busy guy. You're going for like your PhD now in physical therapy. Just crazy, man. I'm so stoked for you. So, you know, another blend, I think, of our two worlds is more or less, not every pill, but man, it sure feels like it, that I prescribe in the world of psychiatry is could make people fat. It's just a simple fact, you know, not necessarily as much with the typical antidepressants, but mood stabilizers, there's a lot of them that valproate, Depakote, or people, or, you know, lithium can make you fat. A lot of the antipsychotics can make you fat. And then I even would argue sometimes one of the symptoms of depression and other mental illness is overeating, unhealthy habits, not having the motivation to exercise. So what I, you know, I know a big part of your world is like, I have a knee injury right now. And I know that if I lose weight, I will take a lot of stress off of that knee joint. So I know that you are very educated in nutrition. I've always known you to be in very great physical shape. And I believe that right now you're still dealing a lot with intermittent fasting. So what do you tell your patients when nutrition and like weight loss especially is a really important component of their care? And what do you try to teach them?
Yeah, so this is, gosh, this is another really big topic for me, Logan. I don't even know where to start. So I'll say, like, as physical therapists, we're not formally trained in nutrition. So there usually this requires additional education, continuing education or certifications on the physical therapy, on the provider standpoint, to be able to provide more in-depth recommendations. So from my standpoint, and it goes a little, I'm gonna deviate a little bit and say the first conversation that I have with the person when we're talking about body adiposity or body habitus and improving body composition is that we don't care as much as to the person that we are at this moment as we do as long as we know that we're moving in the right direction to be that that better vision or person that we want to be this physically or even like with the psychological self, that's more important. So it gets back to like the small habits and the tiny habits and having like a behavioral change approach. So an example that I will often, a resource that I'll often give out to patients will be one, I talk about seeking the advice of a formal nutritionist. I will also endorse a couple of the self-guided and assisted guided programs that exist. So Precision Nutrition is one of them, which focuses less on like the nutritional science component that is, though they're strongly based in that, their emphasis is more on the behavioral change aspect. A more recent one that has come out and that also speaks to the behavioral change approach around eating and around the way that we fuel our bodies and recover is Noom. And so this is like another resource that I would turn your listeners to should they so be interested in like facilitating a better nutritional approach, because there's so much that goes into nutrition and how we why we consume what we do, be this for religious means, culturally, emotionally, can influence the decisions that we make. That's like on the larger scale, and then to your, I want to make sure that I'm hitting the point that your specific question at hand. Because you mentioned a couple things there. You mentioned everything from the side effects of the medications from the adiposity standpoint, and then I guess you used the word like lack of motivation, or with the aspect of like cardiovascular fitness or engaging in a physical exercise regimen. And then you also had the nutrition there. So with the nutritional component, I will often lean on other healthcare providers. I do provide additional insights should patients like ask for it. And I'll give the disclaimer that this is like that I consistently will refer you to your nutritionist or your dietitian, but I will give them I'll feed them resources, no pun intended, that talk about the longevity science about nutrition versus like the sports nutrition. So because there's discrepancies there. So I'll feed them the resources and give my interpretation, but then I'll also give the disclaimer that you need to be talking to these providers. So like the example would be if you look at the international science, I'm sorry, the International Society of Sports Nutrition, and look at their recommendations for protein intake per kilogram of body weight, it's as much as 2.0 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is significantly more than the 0.6 that is recommended by your like the RDA or the like the recommended daily amount. And it's because you have to look at the goals of the individual at hand. So in your athletic population, where your goal is to put on lean muscle mass and sustain that, and you have higher energy demands, versus is your goal to mitigate your chance of non-communicable disease and have live a long and a health more healthy, I don't want to say more healthy, but a healthier lifestyle. So when you look at what they call like blue zones or those pockets around the world where people live longer, then they're going to actually have a lower protein content intake, and it's going to be more from like a plant-based source than is the what the recommend the positional statement from the International Society of Sports Nutrition, where they would say as much as two, again, it's like 2 or 3 times the amount of protein, and their sources are also slightly different. And I'll say that the challenges that we have with nutritional science is that like the food industry in America, I have a vendetta against them. I believe that they are on I'm a little bit I'm I am liberal, but in this standpoint, I'm very conservative, that I believe they are causing mass assassination across our country with the amount of product and additives and changes that they're putting into our food. And I think that one of the things beyond just the politics of the COVID pandemic and how our country has been able to handle it, I also think that we've experienced a lot of additional death rates because of the underlying issues that we have as a society from a nutritional standpoint, when people's A1Cs and their blood glucose and these the amount of inflammatory process that we already had underlying within our society because of the way that we're fueling our bodies and the chemicals that we're exposed to through the food industry is absurd. And I really don't there's certain companies that I endorse that I believe that their food product is great and meant to promote health and the well-being of the individual who's consuming it. And then I also know that there's other industry other companies that are influenced by more financial means, that they're not caring about the consumer of their product. And it's just really unfortunate. And so that's like a whole nother realm as far as like the nutritional component, but it comes back to the standpoint of informing the patient that if they're like, how much protein should I be intaking, right? I'm like, okay, so let's start with the end in mind. What's your goal, right? And and what's contextually, what is that? And then we can talk about like the specific like macro and micronutrients being and getting you on a program that we that may be most beneficial for what the changes that you're trying to make. And then when the with the second component that you you mentioned there, as far as like getting that sense of consistency or overcoming like the initial inertia to engage in a regular physical exercise regimen, especially if you're dealing with some mental like mental health diagnoses such as depression or anxiety, is that there's this threshold at 70% of your heart rate max is when your endorphins are released and your dopamine is spiked. And the significance of this is that at that time, you know, at that threshold, that's what allows for exercise to become more, you know, I guess I'll use the word addictive or enticing, where you would repeat that same action again. And it you know, I talked earlier in our conversation about the BJ Fogg model, but the significance of creating a behavior in this automatic loop is that it becomes habitual, it becomes automatic, and the barriers, the friction, the aversion that one has to being able to carry out that behavior, in this case, the exercise regimen, is significantly reduced, and the likelihood of you to consistently engage in going for a walk, a 30-minute walk every day, becomes less of a choice and a decision point, and more of just like, that's what I do. You know, up to, you know, psychologists would say that up to 40 to 50% of what we do in a given day is habitually driven by these automatic, loops, right? And so it really stems from the standpoint that it's, yes, we have free will, but at the same token, there is circuitry within us that causes us to repeat the same actions time and time again. And if you can get someone on that automatic loop, you even mentioned with like your medications, where it becomes a decision point, or even where potentially even just like cognitive, like forgetfulness, when you can start to, you know, they call it habit stacking, where you have an anchor within your day, something that's going to automatically happen. This could be every time my alarm goes off in the morning, or every time the sun sets, or every time, you know, sometimes we link ourselves to time, right? At noon every day, I'm going to be taking my medication. But when you can have those habitual loops, and then even the stacking of one anchor point on top of another, then you can start to change those behaviors that need to happen into more automatic habitual loops. In this case, the exercise regimen. But then also taking in the nutritional component, that's whatever the end in mind is for that individual, and then pointing them towards resources, be it other healthcare providers, or even programs that exist that can help them to undergo similar behavior changes so that they can improve their overall body habitus, body composition, and most importantly, their life.
Oh yeah, man. Well, I think that's I've taken you about an hour of your time on this wonderful podcast. I hope that you choose to come back again. I'd love to interview for a follow-up episode, because, yeah, I mean, I really enjoy talking about like just kind of motivation, trying to create like consistent health habits, challenges that we both face as you know, providers in this healthcare space, although we have different worlds. But yeah, I've always enjoyed, I got to work with, or I still do work with physical therapists while I'm working in the hospital quite a bit. And yeah, man, it was a wonderful, wonderful podcast. So anything else you'd like to say into the radio internet sphere?
Yeah, I just really want to express my gratitude, Logan. It's, I know that we've talked about having me on for a while now, and it's just, wonderful to have the opportunity to be able to talk to yourself as well as to your listeners about mental health and the components that plays in on physical rehabilitation, and how there's, again, this blend between the two. I'd love the opportunity to come back on and discuss these topics and or others in future. Yeah, so thank you so much. And yeah, I'm a big fan. And so it's great. It's great to be able to speak to you in this context.
The "I didn't realize you liked me that way" deal. Because it's one thing to receive McDonald's, but an entirely other thing to know that they woke up early to face the world and bring you McDonald's breakfast still hot in the bag.
Appreciate you.
There's a deal for every morning. Now grab two loaded sausage burritos for only $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.